Order will come to order. Mr. Test, do you want to give us an update on House Bill 2033, please?
Madam Chair, and there has been the amendments that we had to do on this bill turned out to be a little more complex than was first expected, and we have two sets of amendments on it. One satisfied the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the other was, but not Legislative Council, and the second satisfied. First satisfied Legislative Council, but not Oregon Department of Fish and Game. The second one satisfied Farm and Fish and Game, but not Legislative Council. So three will be a charm. We're going to meet and try and get this moved, the appropriate definition taken care of with the specificity we need, and hopefully to cover the needs of the department and separating the difference between bycatch and intentional or incidental catch. So hopefully within the next, after Thursday, if I can set the right appointment and get the room shut and let them there together for a while, we'll have some amendments that we can work with.
Okay, thank you, Pete. So we should expect that possibly on Thursday?
No, probably by Tuesday.
By next Tuesday. Okay, thank you. So, committee members, basically today we are going to continue the overview of the Oregon plan. We're going to hear from the governor's natural resource advisor, Mr. Jim Brown, and then also we're going to hear some additional information from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and then we're going to hear the series of testimony from agencies that have been very involved in the Oregon plan, and they're going to provide some information about their interaction and how their programs sort of coordinate and help implement the Oregon plan. So first we're going to hear from Mr. Jim Brown, Governor's Natural Resource Advisor. Thank you, Jim, and for the record, can you please state your name?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Brown. I'm the Governor's Natural Resource Policy Director. I've been invited this morning to visit with you a little bit about the Oregon Plan and its vision. I thought I'd briefly go over a little bit of history of how the plan came about, because I think that's an important context for you know, your considerations as you're going through the next few days of hearings. Early in the 1990s, the salmon populations here in Oregon and elsewhere in the Northwest were in serious decline for a series of complex and interacting reasons. In 1995, there were two groups of coho that were proposed for listing by National Marine Fisheries Service under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And at about the same time, about 14,000 miles of streams in the state had been identified as water quality limited. Governor Kitzhaber felt that in many regards we were heading for a train wreck, much like we'd had when the spotted owl was listed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the late 1980s. The Governor Kitzhaber at that time pulled together agencies to try to find a solution using for the salmon and water issue, using both the state's regulatory baseline, but also voluntary actions on the part of the landowner community, that being a voluntary effort being a pretty key component. The effort initially was aimed at coho because that's kind of what was up front. But later, as some populations of steelhead were proposed for listing, the plan was extended to steelhead, and then later was expanded to include all salmonids. And the goal was to recover salmon and watersheds and provide a sustainable social, economic, and environmental benefits to Oregonians, particularly rural Oregonians, because they depend so much on the working landscapes, that is, ag and forestry, and would have been severely impacted by the listings. In 1997, the Oregon Plan was enacted by the legislature and funded by the Legislative Assembly through some special funding. And then in 1999, through ballot measure 66, there was dedicated funding that was provided. Today, the Oregon Plan is a commitment by Oregon citizens, ag and forest landowners, the business organizations, government, NGOs, working together to try to improve watershed health as well as help recover the salmonid populations here in the state. I think the unique thing about the Oregon Plan is the broad level of support and activity that's going on on the ground. I mean, you have 88 watershed councils, you have 45 soil and water conservation districts. You have groups like the Oregon Forest Industries Council and some members of the ag community that are actively participating in this effort. The key points of the plan are the watershed councils and the soil and water conservation districts really working as local delivery mechanisms in terms of both technical assistance and administration of grant funding. You have the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board as an independent agency that's providing or running a grant program that's independent, and I think that's important, independent of any regulatory programs that might be housed in that agency. I think you have efforts trying to sustain our efforts to improve water quality through Senate Bill 1010 and statutes like the Oregon Forest Practices Act. You've had the Department of Fish and Wildlife review their hatchery management practices in a way that complements wild fish. And then you have monitoring and science-based programs that you've codified in statute and that are underway that really provide the basis for active adaptive management, so that as we learn, we change as we go through time. Now, it's my personal view that, and I think it's that of the governor's, that the Oregon Plan is important to Oregonians. It provides a framework for us to discuss the economy and the environment as opposed to the economy or the environment. And you'll note in the governor's inaugural address and then a former speech that he gave at the Economic Summit in Portland that the economy and the environment is an important part of his agenda. The natural resources in this state lead to significant economic activity. They represent collectively ag, forestry, marine, recreation to about $25.8 billion of industrial output. That's about 16% of Oregon's total. So it's a significant economic sector in this state. It's also, as you well know, vitally important to rural communities, which in turn make important contributions to urban areas as well. And it leads to significant social and environmental values that all Oregonians enjoy. And I think what's key about the Oregon Plan is that it leads to significant work by local people that are controlling and tailoring local solutions at work, both for them as well as in the larger context for all Oregonians. And the fundamental mechanisms that are in place are OWEB that manages the grant program and coordinates the monitoring, the agencies like forestry and ag that coordinate the technical assistance to the landowner community, as well as administer the regulatory part of the program that you've provided through statute. And then you have a science oversight that provides that and the monitoring to provide for adaptive management. And then a key piece is the volunteerism that happens by the landowners, the soil and water conservation districts, and the watershed councils. So really what you have, in my opinion, is Oregonians working together, which is no small challenge. I think the challenge that we have in the future is to avoid federal command and control application of federal statutes like the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. And I think what rather we want to do is to have a partnership with the federal government, recognizing that in the end, Oregonians directly or indirectly are going to have to comply with ESA and the Clean Water Act. So to that end, a letter was jointly written and signed by then Governor Kitzhaber and now at that time Governor-elect Kulongoski to Bob Lawn, the regional director of the National Marine Fisheries Service, suggesting that we work together to find a way that the Oregon plan can also meet the requirements of the Federal Endangered Species Act. And I've provided you a copy of that. And a matter of fact, I'll be sending shortly with a cover memo a copy of that letter to all the members of the Assembly. I think if we're going to be successful in working with the federal government to find a way that to have the Oregon plan meet the needs of the ESA, that it's not only going to require the support and help of the folks that have already been involved in this effort up from the ground, but I think that of the Legislative Assembly as well, both in terms of, I think, your moral support, but it's going to be a large effort in order to write an environmental impact statement that's going to be necessary to accomplish that. So there's going to have to be some help for the agencies, I believe, in that arena, either in terms of the structure within the current budgets, within the balanced budget that the governor has recommended, or in some other way. So, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to stop there and answer any questions that the committee might have.
Ms. Brown, I have one question regarding your memo to Mr. Lawn at NOAA. Have you heard any response on this yet, or which?
We had actually had conversations with Mr. Lawn before this letter was written, and he is interested in working with us in a collaborative way to do this.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Brown? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much.
Next, I'd like to call on Jeff Huntington and Jay Nicholas from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. We're going to ask folks to keep their comments to about 15 minutes, but since Mr. Brown was shorter, then we might give you a few minutes, extra minutes if you need it.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Jeff Huntington, the Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and I have with me Jay Nicholas, who is the primary author of the implementation report. Just in case folks needed to have a copy this morning, we brought an extras for the committee. And I will, Jay and I were just talking, we're going to do our best to keep you way ahead of schedule. We're going to try to be just give you a quick lead-in and let you get to the agencies, which is the real purpose of today's presentation. Again, as a refresher, this report was a legislative charge came out of the last session, 2001 legislative session, Senate Bill 945, that asked OWEB to report into the legislature every other year of odd years on specific parts of how implementation of the Oregon Plan is going, a status report on watershed and key habitat conditions in each drainage basin in the state, an overview of agency programs that are addressing watershed conditions, an overview of voluntary restoration efforts, a summary of investments being made by the board, and recommendations of the Watershed Enhancement Board for enhancing the effectiveness of the plan. This is our first tack at it, and what we thought we would do is I'm going to just briefly summarize the recommendations of the report after Jay has taken just a minute to do an example of how this as a working document can be used by you over the course of the session and others over the course of the session when you're intersecting with particular issues that may involve the Oregon Plan, like water quality issues in TMDLs or Senate Bill 1010 or fish passage issues or whatever. And so Jay was going to spend about 5 minutes doing this as a working document to give you some examples of what kind of resource tool it can be, and then we'll step back and let the day go forward.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jay Nicholas, Science and Policy Advisor for OEB. I'm going to step you through a few pages here and show you how this report can be used. And let me tell you that if I think that if you put this report by your bedside at night, you will find it. you will sleep very soundly. There are some folks that this keeps them awake at night. What I'd like to do is...
you cut your hair.
I did. Good morning, Representative Cruz. what I'd like to do is, if you all have the report in front of you, could you turn to page 34 and put open it to page 34 and also put a finger in page 8. We have a two-page layout for each of the 15 basins around the state. And in this section of the report, we have provided some information that we think will be useful working information for folks working on the ground, policymakers, folks trying to figure out what it is we've actually invested money in, what others have invested money in, and what some of the restoration issues are, and the resource status. And for example, each basin we have a map showing spatial locations of where work has been done. A couple of pie charts at the bottom describing what's the land cover. Is it 3/4 forest or 10% forest? Who owns the land in this basin? Private, public. These are key underlying features that they're essential to understand and consider when you're planning restoration. Across the top of the right page, status of current conditions. We have ESA listed species, 303D listed stream segments, reasons that the stream segments were listed. And in the center, the colors on those two basin maps indicate where 10-10 plans have been done, where they're not completed yet, and where the TMDL plans have been done yet. The 10-10 plans and the TMDL plans are the state's method of addressing water quality issues. And the reason I asked you to, we don't really have time today, but one of the wonderful uses of this report is to compare how different basins, the land coverage, land use, ownership varies, and how some of the issues vary. The center strip across the right-hand page is labeled investments. Other words we could have chosen were grants issued, projected monies spent, promises. These are what different agencies have said they have committed to spend in the current biennium. Now, those promises, those projections may or may not be realized in the future. And that's the key. Across the bottom side is accomplishments. And these graphs represent work that has actually been done, finished. We have a point on a map. We can tell you how much it cost, and we can tell you who paid for it. And one example in the Willamette Basin, the very large slice of that pie, private ownership, represents a very large investment by private forest landowners. And this is very important to look at who's funding the work in different basins. Because if you go from basin to basin around the state, you see that some basin private landowners, the forest industry, are tremendous, huge partners. In others, the federal government, for example, the Grand Ronde or the John Day, the federal government is pouring a lot of money into some basins, whereas they're not putting money into other basins. Let me for a moment ask you to turn over to page 36, where we have a summary of information we have from federal agencies, NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service, BPA in the center on the right, and the other federal investments are primarily Forest Service and BLM. One of the exciting things about this report is we've never had this level of information available before. We've had improvements in our databases, data standardization, data sharing and coordination, and reporting that we've harped on folks and we've begged and pleaded for, and some of those requests have actually borne fruit in the last year and enabled us to provide this information. So you can go through, for example, BPA in the center on the right, and you can see they've said they're going to spend roughly $20 million in the current biennium in the John Day, $15 million in the Grand Ronde. There are other basins where they're not investing. Again, the federal, the bottom, rather than being projections, these are actual investments, complete and reported in the year 2000-2001. See, primarily Forest Service and BLM, they actually completed $5 million worth of work in the Umpqua Basin. These are not trivial investments. These are the key things I wanted to mention. One thing I wanted to cover, if you could also turn to page 38.
Madam Chair, may I have a question?
Sure.
Thank you. On page 37, down at the bottom on the left, road, this is federal investments. Tell me about why they would be putting $10 million into the road and why that would be considered an investment.
Representative, thank you. The road category indicates that they have, that whoever it is, whether it's private forest landowners or the federal agencies, they have invested in road work that is designed to reduce erosion, reduce road failures. And erosion and road failures are they're a principal contributor of sediment to streams, mud. Slides that come down and can have adverse effects on salmon and steelhead streams. They're water quality issues, really. And so the road category isn't just making roads nicer to travel on. They're reducing sediment inputs to streams, improving water quality, improving salmonid habitat.
Follow-up? So this would not be necessarily for new roads, but to improve existing roads? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. In fact, I don't think that any of this would be involved with new roads. It might be road surfacing, improving culvert systems on roads so that the roads don't wash out during extreme storm events, that sort of thing.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you. I did have a question, too, before you leave page 37, that middle section where you indicated the BPA funding. And did I understand you correctly to say those were projections and not yet done?
That's correct.
And I just don't see it noted that those are projections.
In an earlier part of the report, we define investments as being projected.
I see.
We've struggled with terminology, and I have discovered that the term investment doesn't really answer everybody's question.
And Madam Chair, Representative, also it's different between different entities. When you talk about an investment that OEB's made, it means that there's a commitment that we've actually allocated the money, we've issued a grant agreement, and it just hasn't been expended yet, and the project hasn't been finished. The Bonneville Power Administration works a little differently, and it's a little less certain about what the final amount will be, even after there's been a commitment to spend money on a particular project. So it's because of the difference, the different ways some of the different granting entities work.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The final remark I'd like to make is on page 38. If you'd look down the left-hand margin of that page, we have a description of some Oregon Plan teams, core team, implementation team, and the monitoring team at the bottom. These are groups of agency folks that have provided information to develop this report. The question comes up sometimes, how do we get information in this? We have pretty close ties, and pretty much everybody in the different agencies knows they cringe when their phone rings and it's me, because I'm asking them for more information or different information or a different analysis of the information that they've already given me. But folks have been very, very cooperative, you know, within their existing workloads, and everybody's trying. The whole idea here is to provide as comprehensive and as coherent a picture as we can about what's the status of the resources in Oregon, what are the investments, what are the accomplishments, so that over time, with successive reports like this, we can track what did we say our priorities were? Have we invested in what we said were priorities? How's our track record for accomplishments? You know, what are we actually achieving? And in the future, has the status of the resource improved as a result of our investments? So that's what we're trying to achieve here. Madam Chair, that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions or pass it over to Jeff.
Any additional questions? Jay, I have one quick one regarding when you're reporting on private investments. Is that, how do you get that information? Is it through, say, NRCS or the Soil and Water Conservation Districts? And is that private funds that are being leveraged with state dollars? Because, you know, I'm curious how you would outreach to landowners that you're collecting this data.
There are a couple ways we get information on private investments. The most comprehensive pipeline we have to report private investments is through private forest landowners. The members of OFIC have made a commitment throughout their institution to report all the restoration work they do. They fill out the forms. They send the information in promptly. It's been a wonderful source of information. They've also made significant commitments throughout their industry to do restoration work. So they're not only doing the work, but they also have a commitment to reporting it. Now, we think that there is also a lot of private investment from agricultural landowners. However, we're also told that there's a lot of, I see Pete Tess smiling, that there's a lot of reluctance to report that work, not wanting to draw attention to themselves, where their farms are, what they're doing. So they're doing the work, but they're just not reporting it. We're working on that. The ag representatives are working on that, but we don't feel like we have a clear picture of what those folks are doing. Now there's another kind of private investments. Anytime there's an OWEB grant that is based on leveraging or sharing or partnering with other funders, private or public, as every OWEB grant, we have to, you know, part of the conditions of that grant is we've got to get a report on it and see what's the work being done, where is it, and who's paying for it. So any private parties that are supporting work that also gets OWEB funds, we have records of those. But for all we know, there's work being done through NRCS and by ag landowners and small woodlot owners, mm-hmm. who also they share a reluctance to tell the government what they're doing. So our picture of private investments is very limited at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would actually echo those sentiments. As a fifth-generation farmer, I can tell you that many of my fellow farmers are somewhat distrustful of government and simply don't want anyone knowing what they're trying to do, and usually they're trying to do the right thing anyway. But it's unfortunate that that's the case, but until probably some other things change and the federal government at least goes forth with allowing these types of things to happen where Oregon can have limits for 4D take rules until that time when that becomes established and there's some time period for that to work. I doubt if that mentality is going to change any. So, you know, hopefully it will at some point in time, and we can be successful with that. Couple of questions for you. Your monitoring team consists of who? And the second question is, are you satisfied that the information, the data that they're collecting regarding TMDLs and evaluation is accurate?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, the very best thing for me to do right now is defer to the presentation on Thursday, where Kelly Moore will be here. He is the Oregon Plan Monitoring Program Coordinator.
DQ and ODFW.
Yeah, DQ and ODFW will also be part of that presentation, if I may.
That's fine. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Gentlemen, Jeff, do you want to close?
If I can, as we talked last week, the other half of the document beginning on page 38 and on is broken into those four legs of the Oregon Plan looking at a statewide. And what we've done now for the next couple of days is to try and structure the presentation so they take on each of those four components of the plan. And so today and beginning on Thursday, we'll have agencies talking about how they contribute to the Oregon Plan and where they plug in. And you can look in the agency action section. There's four pages from 38 to 42 that talk about fish management, water quality, water quantity issues that will be addressed. The monitoring team representatives and I will be back also on Thursday to talk about some of the voluntary restoration actions very briefly, but mostly monitoring and what's happening on tracking where we're going. And then I believe one of the co-chairs of the independent multidisciplinary science team, the oversight panel, will be here to address the committee either this week or next Tuesday, talk about the fourth leg. And so you can use this document as you're listening to those presentations and discussing the plan from a 40,000 foot level, looking at what's going on across the whole state as opposed to basin by basin. And the last thing I will point out to you is page 54 and 55. And as part of the charge, the board did lay out some recommendations that it believes can affect promote and enhance the implementation of the plan. And I think you'll see some of those already coming into play. Jim Brown talked about securing federal recognition and working on that. That was something that my board feels very strongly about. Jay's already mentioned trying to find ways to improve access to information. We are working hard to put in place the long-term tracking mechanisms for recovery trends, and we'll discuss that in the monitoring team. Last note, as part of using the document, particularly on the agency actions and the four prongs, you will see blocks of green that are general observations, and that's places where we did well over 100 of interviews with different constituents, districts, councils, and people working on the ground to talk about, and agency staff to talk about, things they were seeing that might be impediments, hurdles that we need to get over, and places that we could work harder with respect to that particular part of the plan. So that's an area where you can just kind of plug in and get a snapshot of what's happening from a perspective different than ours. We tried to just roll those up and compile them and synthesize the big points that we were seeing across the state in all basins there. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, are we to return these books and bring our own copies next time?
You're welcome to keep them. Fine, or we can collect them back from the committee administrator after the hearing. Either way, whichever you would prefer.
If you want to keep an extra copy, pass it on to your friends for night bedtime reading.
Right, yeah.
Okay, next up we have John Lilly from the Oregon Division of State Lands, who's Assistant Director of Policy and Planning. Welcome, John, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is John Lilly. I'm the Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands, and I deal primarily with policy and planning. And I have to say, we're delighted to be able to present to you today about this the Oregon Plan for Salmon Watersheds. My director, Ann Hannes, is attending another meeting. There's a conflict at this time, and but we're really happy to be able to do this. For some of you who are new, the Division of State Lands is a relatively small agency when it comes to staff, but we have a wide range of responsibilities that we have under our reign, I guess you might say. And they break down into kind of three general areas of responsibility. One is as a land manager. The Division of State Lands manages submerged and submersible lands. That's the beds and banks of navigable waterways and tidally influenced waters, as well as the territorial sea. That's the 3 miles out from the low tide line out to the 3 nautical miles from the coastal shore. In addition, and those we typically refer to as non-trust lands, the second type of land that we manage are called common school trust lands, and those are lands that are managed in more or less an entrepreneurial fashion to provide monies to the common school fund, and that the revenues from those lands, from timber harvest, from grazing, from agricultural leases and such, go into the common school fund and then are reinvested in a portfolio that then later is portions of which are distributed to the schools twice a year. There's 133,000 acres of forest land within that common school trust land portfolio, and there's another 600,000 acres of range and agricultural lands. Much of that is under lease. The second area that I would refer to for the agency's responsibilities, what you call environmental protection, that's the state's removal fill program, or dredge and fill, or wetlands conservation, or however you might hear about it. But basically, it's a program been in effect since the late 60s that says that if folks want to fill or remove materials from the beds and banks of waterways in the state and wetlands, they must have a permit from the Division of State Lands, basically, to do that work. There are a number of exemptions for activities. There's limitations in terms of volume that can be removed without a permit. And there's areas of waters of the state that are regulated and some are not. And then the third area is what I call research and education. And we have a component property down at South Slough near Charleston. It's called the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve. We operate that in partnership with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration of the federal government. It's the first national estuarine reserve of its kind. It was established in the early 70s. And its primary function is research of pristine estuary, as well as education and recreation. We run a number of school children through that facility annually, do a lot of education, you know, outdoor school type education down there. And interestingly, they do a lot of research on estuarine activities and interrelationships between salmonids and restoration of streams and marshlands. We've been involved in salmon recovery, I think, for quite a while, but most pointedly beginning in 1995 when the legislature established the Essential Salmon Habitat statute, which said that on rivers or streams where there are listed salmonids, state or federal listed salmonids, that there would be no cubic yard limitation to institute regulation under the state removal fill law. To say that more clearly, in most waters of Oregon, if you are filling or removing 50 yards of material, then you do not need a permit. But the legislature felt at that time, because of the abundance of listed species, salmonids in particular, that there needed to be a stronger regulation and a little more oversight over activities within streams of that nature. And at that point, then, they said in 1995 that we should establish by rule designations over streams that were used for spawning and rearing habitat and designate those streams and regulate all fill and removal within those streams. So we've been doing that since about 1996. There are about 18,000 miles of streams in the state that are subject to that regulation. By our count, there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 miles or 110,000 miles of stream in the state. So you can kind of get a sense of how many streams are actually covered by essential habitat. Since the mid-90s, DSL has been involved in a great deal with the Oregon Plan, and most recently, I want to list some of the activities that we've been involved with. Over the course of the discussion, I think my colleague agencies will tell you probably a lot greater detail of some of the activities they're involved with, and maybe talk more about the organizational structure of how agencies work with OWEB and others to deal with the Oregon Plan. But I thought I'd focus on a few specifics of what the division has been involved with. Because of our regulatory responsibility, it comes from time to time a permittee, an applicant for removal field permit, may need to do mitigation, compensatory mitigation. And sometimes that might be in the form of payment to provide. In other words, they're given a permit, allowed to do the work. In return, they put up a sum of money in a mitigation account, and the division then finds someone to do work that would provide mitigation or replacement habitat for the habitat that's being lost. We work with watershed councils and interest groups and others, landowners, to kind of link up the person doing the permitting or getting the permit and the person or the entity that wants to do some habitat restoration, so that those projects can come together and the development work can be done and the habitat mitigation can be done, and that the agency's responsibilities or permit requirements are met in that fashion. Sometimes we accept the dollars into our mitigation account, and then the permittee's responsibilities are fully discharged. We take on the responsibility of finding the mitigation project and moving the money to that particular entity. It could be a watershed council, it could be Ducks Unlimited, it could be another agency. As a land manager, we just recently conducted a rangeland health analysis on 40,000 acres of our rangeland in southeast Oregon, and intend to do another 50,000 acres in this next year. That's the first time since 1974 that we've been doing a comprehensive analysis of rangeland health and condition. There have been many land exchanges on our ground since the early 70s, and as a result, we're getting a chance to look at the condition in a comprehensive way for the first time in quite a while. I've mentioned the South Slough area. They've done some work on restoring Anderson Creek, and they're using that as a restoration and monitoring project where they can look to see how the environment of that creek is responding to restoration and how that might be helping salmonids returning to that area. From the regulatory perspective, you might find in the OWEB report that one of the items that the OWEB board identified was that folks that wanted to get involved in habitat restoration sometimes found themselves thwarted in their attempts to do good things because of the regulatory process kind of got in their way. We've been sensitive to that. That's not a criticism unique to just folks who want to do restoration. We often hear that criticism from folks who also want to do economic development activities. But nonetheless, being aware of that helped us as we began to identify ways in which we might be able to help people who'd want to do watershed restoration work, principally wetland restoration and fish enhancement projects. We revised our regulations to make it a little easier for those projects to go through. We also did some things like Kelly mentioned, Jay mentioned earlier, the culverts, the issue of road culverts, and how much money is being invested in improving culverts, for example. Well, we found that we had an unintended consequence of the state's regulations on removal fill, where it actually required an individual permit for some of these culverts to be replaced. So you had a good idea, something that needed to be done, make culverts able to pass fish. But a process that stood in the way and stretched out the process for actually being able to get that work done. And in some cases, the money, as is the case, began to dry up because the project couldn't move fast enough. So in our most recent revision to our regulations, we've eased those particular portions of the regulation dealing with culvert replacement so that we're delineating very carefully under what circumstances culverts can be replaced without needing a permit. So that's one thing. And the other is You know, obviously we'll have some discussion, I'm sure, in this committee and others about the state's overall effort to streamline the federal government permitting process with the Corps of Engineers, where the state, the Division of State Lands, is proposing to have the authority of the Corps of Engineers transferred to the state so that basically there would be something akin to one-stop permitting, which will help not only folks interested in doing Oregon plan work, but also folks that are interested in doing highway construction or economic development projects throughout the state. We're not saying that we're necessarily lowering the bar to resource protection, but rather making it more certain and more streamlined for the permitting process to be carried out. From a performance basis, we do a lot of compliance monitoring of the conditions and how applicants do the work after the permit is issued. And we're looking to see how well folks are able to comply with permit conditions. And we've done a five-year study. We continue to add on to this annually. And right now we're seeing a steady increase in compliance to 81% for this past year. In other words, 81% of the operators are complying with permit terms and conditions. Sometimes being out of compliance doesn't mean that that's a bad thing. That's necessarily a wrong thing. It means that they are out of compliance, but it could mean that our condition was improper, that it wasn't well thought out, that it wasn't we're not achieving what we wanted to achieve, for example. And so we look at the results of that work and say, all right, this person is out of compliance, but why?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei,
could you give us an example, please, of that?
Yeah, sometimes it's, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, it could be in terms of turbidity. Sometimes the short-term turbidity requirements that we have in our conditions are very strict, and we need to look at those and see if we can't adjust those to allow the work to be done and still have the minimal impact on the water resource itself and on fish, but maybe write our conditions in such a way that they're a little more understandable and enforceable.
Thank you.
Just to add on to that, oftentimes it's the feedback from the permittee that's very helpful, just to find out just how well they were able to comply in reading the terms and conditions of the permit and then actually doing it on the ground. In some places, they might refer to that as adaptive management. And finally, I would say that the division has been involved in a number of watershed councils, not only as a member but as a contributor. We're one of the partners on the McKenzie Watershed Council, which was one of the earliest ones to get underway, and we also are closely involved in the Oahe Watershed Councils, simply because a great deal of the common school trust land that's used for grazing is in the southeastern part of the state. That concludes my comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Sure.
Representative.
Thank you. John, good to see you.
A couple of questions, actually really just one here. The agency is oftentimes accused of being inflexible, and I, in fact, have introduced legislation on behalf of Mr. Mel Stewart, whom your agency's had a long-running discussion with for about 10 years, mm-hmm. And I had the occasion to recall Mr. Bob Caravan's circumstance with your agency also. I'm very pleased to hear that you're wanting to employ flexibility in terms of how you're applying standards so that the one-size-fits-all approach is rethought and allow some flexibility to allow people individually to meet the terms and provisions of what we're trying to achieve overall in terms of compliance issues. Are there some other things that your agency is bringing forward in terms of ideas like this? Do you have specific concepts that are coming to us that would help us, help you, have that flexibility to make all of this work in a fair and balanced manner?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, not specifically in the form of pre-session file legislation, but quite frankly, our foreknowledge of the fact that there would be legislation in the wings introduced by some of the people that you've mentioned only provides us with an opportunity to take a hard look at the way these programs might, and the removal fill program in particular, might be adjusted and tweaked in order to address some of the concerns that you're aware of. In large part, the differences of opinion that exist between the parties that you've identified are based upon current law or past regulation. In the interim, we haven't been able to do anything about the law. However, we have been able to address issues that relate to administrative rule. And the most recent version of our administrative rules tend to provide greater flexibility in those areas that where there have been those types of differences of agreement, as you've mentioned. And I'm being somewhat obtuse here because we're in litigation with administratively with Mr. Stewart and judicially with Mr. Caravan. And I'm not a principal in either one of those issues. We are interested in the policy aspect of them, and we would like to move from the case-by-case litigation mode into resolving the policy-level issues that can be done at either the administrative rule level or through legislation. We'd be glad to work with your office or anyone else on those matters.
Okay, thank you, John. Appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Any other questions for the panel? For John? Thank you, John. Next up, we have the Oregon Water Resources Department, Tom Paul and Adam Sussman. Does want to draw straws about who goes first? Or
good morning. For the record, my name is Adam Sussman, Senior Policy Coordinator with Water Resources Department, and with me I have Tom Paul, who's the Administrator of our Field Services Division, where all of our on-the-ground Oregon Plan activities take place. So Tom will be real helpful in answering those kinds of questions. I do have for you two items that were passed out. One is a follow-up memo from our meeting last week. There were some questions asked about three or four issues, and we provided a follow-up memo, so you should have that with you. And then we have some testimony for this morning. And we want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on the Water Resources Department's role in collaborating to implement the Oregon Plan. And since you've had a long briefing on our agency and our programs, I'm just going to dive right into how the Water Resources Department plugs in this collaborative effort. As we talked in our overview, we do have a challenge of balancing the demand for new water supplies along with stewardship of the resource, and specifically with protection of the needs of threatened and endangered species. And since the mid-90s, our Oregon Plan activities basically fall under three categories, which is how we plug in. Number one, we work collaboratively and provide voluntary tools for maintaining and restoring stream flow. We work cooperators in improving fish passage at in-stream structures. And we also work with folks to protect against salmonid mortality through the placement of fish screens. Now, when we're engaged in these activities, some of the ways that we measure success is by evaluating certain things. Number one, are we actually restoring stream flow, which we can do through our stream flow monitoring efforts? And number two, are we restoring stream flows in watersheds with the highest need? Are we getting the biggest bang for our buck through our efforts? And third, are we regulating water users to protect water rights, both out-of-stream users and in-stream water rights within our priority date-based system? And as I mentioned, the way that we do these things is by using incentive-based voluntary tools that have been provided to us by the legislature. And by working collaboratively with water users, local organizations and the other natural resource agencies. I'm going to let Tom tell you a few things about what specifically we've done.
Good morning. For the record, Tom Paul, Administrator of Field Services Division of Water Resources Department. As Adam indicated, you know, it's quite a job, and you're aware of the size of the agency that we have. Looking at the task in front of us, one of the steps we took was to work jointly with other state agencies, and specifically Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, to identify the highest priority streams where we could spend our time and get the biggest bang for the buck. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife presented information to us that indicated the streams that had the highest need for flows in relation to fish needs. And then our field staff looked at those streams to determine which streams had the greatest opportunity to have water restored based on water right information and water use knowledge that our field folks had. If you take a look at our testimony that we presented to you on the back page, there's a map, and it's a stream flow restoration priorities map. You'll see on that that the, I'll call it pink, I guess, darkest pink color, is where our field staff are currently focusing their efforts on stream flow restoration activities, working cooperatively with landowners and water users. Each of our water masters has developed a work plan and identified a handful of measures that they can take on, working jointly with landowners to address push-up dam issues, to get information out on our in-stream lease program, which is a voluntary program, other measures such other actions such as that. We have entered into cooperative efforts with landowners and other state agencies. John Lilly just talked about the Division of State Lands and their fill removal issues. You will notice in your Oregon Plan report, I think it's on about page 12, the Rogue Basin, one of the priorities in that area is to address 1,000 fish passage issues. We have been out working with the state agencies and landowners to find cooperative solutions to address those fish passage issues and have been very successful.
Representative?
So I'm assuming that most of the dark pink and the rogue is specifically passage?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, it could be flow issues, it could be passage issues, combination.
I just find it interesting that a huge concentration there, a fair amount in the Umpqua Basin and relatively little in the Willamette Basin. But.
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, a lot of that has to do with the method of which is used to divert the water. There are a lot of push-up dams, a lot of gravity water delivery systems in the Rogue, open ditches and canals, whereas in your area, a lot more pumps, and in the Willamette, almost exclusively pumps. So in the Willamette, you could have some fish screen issues on diversions, whereas in the Rogue, you're going to have a lot more of the push-up dam and the fish passage concerns.
Madam Chair? Representative, those of us who are the uninitiated, what is the push-up dam?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, a practice, if you have an open canal to divert water, often during low flow periods, the water users have had to actually push gravel that's in the bed of the stream, push it up as a barrier across the stream to force the water into the canal and ditches.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you.
I have a question for you, Paul. Are all folks that basically have water right permits required to have measurement devices, or is that,
Madam Chair,
something that you rely upon, USGS or stream gauges? I mean, how accurate is our data currently on especially some of the basins that have high priority water needs?
Madam Chair, big question. As far as USGS and our gauging stations, most of those are placed on streams, and we use that information to monitor in-stream water rights. I'm not aware of any USGS activity, and even our state gauges are not on diversions of private irrigators or water users. We do have authority, and we have required measuring devices on diversions when our water masters need that information for regulatory purposes, but by no means are all diversions in the state measured.
So the water master makes that decision? It's a basin-by-basin decision?
Madam Chair, our water masters make that decision based on regulatory need. Nearly all of our permits, at least our the permits that allocate a larger quantity of water, do have a permit requirement now, which does require metering, and that has been the case since about 1995-1996.
Okay, thank you.
We also work closely with watershed councils, providing information and data to them, and provide them with water rate information as well. You folks have been very helpful in helping us carry out our collaborative voluntary efforts. There have been a number of law changes over the past few sessions that have really helped water users address some of the passage issues. These include split season lease opportunity. It used to be that to do a lease, you had to dry up a parcel of ground for the entire season. Now there's an opportunity for a landowner to actually use the water during part of the season and then lease it in stream during part of the season. There are also opportunities for diverters to change their point of diversion from surface water to a hydraulically connected groundwater development, and that eliminates the need for this push-up dam. It also has a side benefit, often, of improving water quality for the diverter so that they are dealing with plugged screens and plugged nozzles in their sprinklers. Additionally, legislation has been adopted to allow substitutions going from a surface water source to a supplemental groundwater source, and then allowing that original surface water right to remain in stream for flow augmentation. In 2002, we had nearly 400 cubic feet per second of water that was placed in stream through either leases, transfers, or allocations of conserved water. So those are some of the major activities that we've been involved with.
I just wanted to add, Chair Dingfelder, some thoughts about where do we go from here for the Water Resources Department and the state. And for the Water Resources Department, we need to continually evaluate our efforts to ensure that they're adding value both to the resource and to the water users. And the tools that we've been provided have been really useful in that effort. The Water Resources Department also is taking a hard look at developing a strategy and thinking of ways to fund a long-term water supply planning and management effort, because this will allow us to both address the stream flow deficiencies that we get seasonally and also to look at water use efficiency and how we're going to meet the needs of a growing population. And finally, as Jim Brown mentioned earlier, understanding what kind of effort and resources might be needed, we believe it's very important to pursue options for securing some sort of federal recognition of the Oregon Plan as a vehicle to meet Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Act requirements, which will provide much greater certainty to the myriad of water users that are out there. And finally, and most importantly, we need to keep up the cooperative and collaborative efforts that have been initiated. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you. A couple of questions. Tom, you just mentioned that it was 2,000 CFS has been added to streams?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I believe in 2002 about 400 cubic feet per second has been added to streams.
And which was that broadly across most of the streams in the state? Is there a list of those that we could see?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, yes, we can supply a list by area. It may not be specific as to the total number or the each individual lease, but we can certainly provide that information on a local basis.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, if I may. In the response to questions, we talk a little bit about Klamath adjudication, and there was a period of where in 1990 and 1991, and then again in 97, where there were 728 claims filed for water use. And there was an inspection period, and then there was a contest period, which there were 5,664 contests filed against 673 of those claims. And you've been engaged in working your way through that, through administrative hearings, and you resolved a large number of those. What types of contests were these?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I don't know that either one of us are the best ones to address this one. And we can provide additional information as to the character of the challenges. I'm sure some of them, historically, in other adjudications, challenges have been one neighbor to another challenging because of the claimed date, priority date. And as you know, the priority date is very important. And I think some of our challenges in the Klamath have been relating to that priority date issue. Another type has been the quantity of water that is being requested. Other than that, I don't know the specifics. I have not been dealing with them.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, if I could request of the department, if you could look into that and give me, I'm assuming this is public information by virtue of the fact that this is a public process. I'd like to have a list of individuals or organizations that are filing the claim. I'd like to see all the claims. I find it extraordinary that we can file 728 claims for water in a very short period of time and then have a phenomenal amount of contests to that, unless that's normal. In my experience as an irrigator and filing water claims, that isn't normal. So I guess, you know, the Klamath adjudication process has been very controversial for a long time and will probably remain so. I'm just curious to know who's filing all these contests, and I'd like to have a list of who they are. I just find this astounding that we'd have this many. I do praise you, however, in working through the resolution process. I think it's unfortunate we've had to dedicate 4 to 5 people to this process just to handle these adjudication claims, just for these small water claims that were brought forward. But I commend you for doing that. And if you could provide that information for me, I'd sure appreciate it.
Sure.
Any other questions for the panel? I just want to comment that when I worked at the Tualatin, I worked very, very closely with the Water Master, and was probably on the phone at least twice a week with Water Masters who provide a lot of excellent information. I did have one question, Adam, regarding your comment about long-term water supply plans. Can you just expand on that a little bit and talk about water supply planning and how that fits in with the Oregon plan and if that's part of the assessment process that's currently going on in the basins?
Chair Dingfelder, for the Water Resources Department specifically, in our duty of balancing both the resource and the demands, it is, we believe, incumbent upon us to thinking about how we meet those future demands at the same time recognizing the stream flow deficiency. So the effort that we have been undertaking as an agency, we've completed the problem identification phase, and everybody is pretty clear on what the issue is. And what we believe we need to do is have some sort of coordinated statewide kind of strategic direction for securing long-term water supplies. You know, the state is in a mode right now where we have job security. You've heard on the radio we have food insecurity, and we don't want to add to that list water insecurity. So what we would like to do is get the stakeholders together and talk about how are we going to plan and fund for securing these long-term water supplies. And what we are doing as an agency, in fact, with our Water Resources Commission at our February meeting, is we have developed what we are calling a solutions panel. And we're asking stakeholders from many different areas to come and talk to the department and the commission and help us begin to kind of pick apart some of the big policy issues, such as what's the role of the Water Resources Department in such an effort? What's the role of other state agencies? What's the role of local governments? How's it going to be funded, and what should it look like? So for us, that's the effort that we're undertaking at Water Resources.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, one additional question. Thank you. It appears that we've got a, hopefully not, but at least initially it looks like we're going to have a lower than normal snowpack. That will probably relate to water use issues. That also relates to the salmon plan, or the Oregon plan, I should say, in regards to water temperature issues and release of waters from stored water, federal government projects. What do you see as your role in that issue as it develops here through the spring and the summer?
Madam Chair, Representative Crow, specifically in the Willamette, we work very closely with other state agencies and the Corps of Engineers on releases from the federal projects in the Willamette. We take to the table our knowledge of water rights, water contracts for that stored water. Very little of the water in the Willamette project or Willamette projects is contracted for, only about 10%. Our work with the Corps is to figure out what to do with the other 90%. And to balance between the recreational needs and interests as well as the environmental interests with stream flows for fish to address Oregon plan issues, also for recreation on the river itself for boating and fishing opportunities there. So we are doing that. Our agency has the ability in declared droughts to work very closely with water users on drought permits. We did that extensively down in the Klamath and scattered a little bit throughout the rest of the state during our last low flow episode, and we're prepared to continue that activity as well this year.
Thank you.
It's kind of a follow-up, and I've had issues, Madam Chair, with the Corps for a long time. I think they're incredibly poor managers. My last trip to Oak Ridge, which is in my district, was about a month ago, and the reservoirs up there are about a third full. And, the Corps tends to do things on a schedule regardless of the weather patterns that we're in. Have we made any headway at all with them on trying to be sensitive to, because our weather patterns have changed. We're getting our rain at different times of the year than we used to, and so to keep reservoirs empty in January, as a backfill for, flood prevention or whatever their reason is, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So we're going to have a minimal snowpack, and we're going to have empty reservoirs, so we're kind of exacerbating the situation. Are we making any progress with those folks at all? I had some summer issues with them, what they did in Cougar and a few things like that, but that's, I don't want to get into that at this point in time. But specifically, this has been a frustration for me over time, is their inability to go into the summer season with full reservoirs.
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, we have had those discussions with the Corps on a pretty regular basis. And they have been pretty good to work with based on weather conditions and snowpack. I'll share a situation that we had. We were real close to having the Corps agree to a rule change curve on Detroit.
Okay.
And, you know, we were a year not unlike what we're going into now. Snowpack was down. Reservoir storage was down. It was a little later. It was, I think, April when we were meeting with the Corps. And they were seriously considering a change. All of a sudden in May, a thunderstorm hits, goes right up the San Diem Canyon, and in a day and a half, Detroit Reservoir went from being way low to spilling water. It was full. The projects in the Willamette are there for primarily flood control purposes. And that's why the Corps is very reluctant to move off those rule curves, because their operation does protect communities of Eugene, Salem, Albany, and Portland. Kaiser, if you'll remember a few years ago, did have flood water in and around some homes. And without the Willamette projects, some areas of Kaiser could be flooded on a pretty regular basis.
I guess, and I know there's no simple answer to this, but I mean, there are more impoundments in the Willamette system than any place else in the state by a large number. And when I look at a lot of our water quality problems in the state, they're, in my opinion, water quantity problems more than anything. And it seems to me that there's got to be a better way to enter the dry season with enough reserve to mitigate some of that, and it just doesn't seem like we do.
Any other questions for the panel? Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And last but not least, we will hear from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife from the director, Lindsay Ball. And I don't see Roy Elliker going to be joining in, Lindsay.
No, I think.
He didn't get fired or anything, did he?
No, not yet.
Wow.
Ooh.
He's my constituent, so I'll let him know that.
Yeah. New governor, musical chairs, you know the whole thing. So it's
that's what people
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thank you for this opportunity to come and speak about the Oregon plan with you today. I think I'll start by commenting that chapters 496 through 513 of the Oregon Revised Statutes are the chapters that provide authority to the Department of Fish and Wildlife to manage Oregon's fish and wildlife species. And as part of Oregon's Department of Fish and Wildlife statutory responsibility to manage the state's fish and wildlife resources, under the Oregon Plan, as our role, we monitor and maintain the health of fish populations. We recommend appropriate habitat and environmental conditions for fish at different life cycle stages. We manage the harvest of fish, including quotas, bag limits, and methods of harvest of the fisheries. We also cooperate with state, federal, and certainly tribal co-management partners in fish management. We work with the public through watershed councils and other interested parties to maintain populations at optimal levels. As I mentioned, conservation and fish management is the purpose and responsibility and authority of ODFW. And what the Oregon plan has really brought to the table for the people of Oregon is a coordinated response that helps us, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, achieve our goals for recovery. We want to delist these fish under the Oregon plan. And we also want to avoid any further listings. It's extremely important to me and my staff. I'd like to take you back a little bit in time to the close of the last session and when I became the permanent director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife at the start of the 2001-03 biennium. We identified the Oregon plan as a priority for the agency, but most importantly, excuse me, but most importantly, we challenged ourselves to be leaders of the Oregon Plan in the state of Oregon. We measure our success by avoiding federal or state listings of species on the endangered species list and by providing healthy fisheries for our public. Our success is the result of the efforts of our staff, professional biologists, engineers, and technicians who are funded by a variety of sources, Measure 66 being one of them. And the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds is both a statement of expectations and purpose and a collaborative process to restore and protect Oregon salmonids and watersheds that support them. A few of the accomplishments that we've experienced in the department under the umbrella of the Oregon Plan is that in the last couple of years, we worked extremely hard on monitoring the Klamath Mountain steelhead. That is a population of fish that is shared with Northern California. The research staff in the Department of Fish and Wildlife set out on an ambitious schedule to monitor that Klamath Mountain steelhead population. We avoided a listing that had been petitioned, and in fact, the work of Oregon also spilled over into California and avoided a listing for their population of that Klamath Mountain province steelhead as well. I think that is a true testament of what can happen when people work together. And by working together, 97%, and I think this is important to note, 97% of the private landowners in that region allowed our fisheries biologists access to their property so we could monitor those steelhead populations in those different watersheds. Without that kind of cooperation, we could not have been able to bring forward sufficient information to avoid the listing that was petitioned.
Lindsay, can you, for especially some of the newer members of the committee, explain what you mean when you say avoid listing, how you did that through the monitoring information, through the monitoring that you did? In other words, was it that you were able to, I mean, can you explain that for some of the newer members that aren't familiar with the listing process?
Chair Dingfelder, very simply, to avoid a listing, you have to be able to document and illustrate to NOAA Fisheries that you have sufficient numbers in your population that population will sustain itself over time. Then there are different parameters that are put on those sustainable factors. That's basically what it amounts to.
Thank you.
In addition to the Klamath Mountain steelhead, we were also able to successfully document the presence of the Great Basin Red Band trout in southeast Oregon and avoided a listing there under the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well. Now, what this really does for people in Oregon is it eliminates restricted angling opportunities by avoiding listings, and it also avoids restrictions that are placed on landowners. We can basically continue our business with some voluntary compliance to enhance the habitat for some of those native stocks. Another accomplishment that I think is extremely important, and many of the veteran legislators in the building can remember some of the long and arduous fish discussions that we had in previous sessions. The department's worked very hard in coming forward with a native fish conservation policy that was passed by the commission in November that I think has taken a lot of the controversy out of hatchery fish versus wild fish. We consider both of those fish important to the state and to the people of Oregon. We're certainly having to live under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and we're also going to be raising hatchery fish for people to catch. Once a hatchery fish spawns in the wild, that progeny is considered a native fish, just like fish that are hatched in the wild from a wild pair. In addition to that, we're going to be working very closely with Oregon State University on a concept at the mothballed ODFW hatchery on Fall Creek to look at a fish research hatchery center. It's going to be very important as we move forward with managing our hatchery stocks in the state. We've also worked extremely hard at development and implementation of a selective ocean fishing strategy for hatchery coho salmon. That allows both sport and commercial interest to fish in the ocean on those stocks when we have abundant numbers. We also provide technical information to educate and inform local watersheds throughout the OWEB grant application process. We want grant applications and money spent where it's going to do the fishery the most good, and that requires us to assist our citizen volunteers out there with where we need to put the money and the projects. Fish screening passage and our fish screening and passage program from 99 through 2003, we have installed 365 screens and 20 fishways. We have 298 screening projects and passage projects under development. We have prioritized over 3,000 in the state, statewide, and those screens and passages should be in place by the year 2011 in our long-term plan.
Lindsay, I have a quick question about the funding for those projects. Is that mainly through OWEB, or do you still have a separate fund for funding fish screening?
Chair Dingfelder, there is money provided through the Mitchell Act and BPA for fish screening in the Columbia Basin. There is an additional $4 million through Measure 66 monies that is devoted to fish screening in other areas of the state.
Thank you.
We have also developed and maintained a fish habitat distribution database that provides for the first time a single database that documents the known or probable distribution of all salmon and steelhead statewide, and that is used extensively by our Oregon Plan partners. There are 12 biologists throughout Oregon that work on restoration programs and provide technical assistance to forest landowners and habitat restoration projects on private lands. I'd like to comment a little bit about what the fishery means for the state of Oregon. Now, this is just not salmon and steelhead, but collectively in Oregon, the sport angler spent $733 million in 2001, as documented by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. That created a personal income of $298 million, and it generated $23.3 million of general fund, as defined by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So I think sustaining a fishery in Oregon is good for the fishery, and of course it's certainly beneficial to the resource. And also in recent years, the commercial fishing industry has provided 7 to 8% of the income on coastal Oregon, and as much as 10% in the communities of Newport and Astoria. To give you a little bit of an insight as to what's to take place this coming year with respect to salmon runs, we expect one of the largest returns in the Willamette Basin on spring Chinook. Our steelhead numbers look strong as well. We are looking at above average run in the Columbia Basin with about 145,000 fish above Bonneville. Not as high as it was the previous 2 years, but certainly well above the last 10-year average. We have experienced and observed on the coastal returns for this fall. All the analysis has not been done yet, but preliminary information is that we have got record numbers of wild coho, hatchery coho, and chinook in many of our streams, which is a good thing. We've also had some of our local biologists proposing that we may possibly want to authorize some seasons on those stocks pending approval from National Marine Fisheries Service. For instance, in some of our reaches, we have twice the carrying capacity of spawners coming back on coho. We might be able to allow some terminal fisheries on some of those stocks once again. So it's looking very favorable from what we've seen. They're also the agency responsible for monitoring and evaluating the status and health of coastwide fish populations. And this information, of course, is used by all of our partners in the Oregon plan. I would also like to talk a little bit about futuring, a little bit of vision for where we are going with the Oregon plan today. When it's all boiled down from the 27 volumes of the Oregon plan, the multitude of watershed councils and the funding processes, the Oregon plan is a statement of expectations and purpose and a collaborative process to restore, protect Oregon salmonids and watersheds that support them. I think that is extremely important. We believe in the Department of Fish and Wildlife, in order to sustain this process, we must shift from recovery planning to recovery actions. Ed Bowles, my fish division administrator, is constantly commenting to me, we need to get out of the planning stage and into the action stage. We've got the native fish conservation policy in place. We're working on the hatchery policy as well. We're going to move this thing forward. We're developing clear policies for protection and recovery, such as the Native Fish Conservation Plan and the Hatchery Management Policy. We're defining success in terms of biological status of species and their habitats. In other words, we're setting the bar. Working with Oregon Plan partners to ensure that protection and recovery actions are consistent with our fish management plans and policies. We're leading efforts to resolve funding and other obstacles in the implementation of the Oregon Plan. We participate in various recovery forums to ensure that the goals developed in these forums reflect our partners' common goals. We're maximizing restoration efforts to accelerate delisting. We monitor and evaluate the biological status of species and their habitats. And I guess in closing, I want to reaffirm that this agency, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, is going to be a lead agency of the Governor's Office, the Oregon Legislature, NOAA Fisheries certainly, public interest groups, landowners and citizens, and other interested parties in seeking solutions. In doing so, we will lead with the highest regard for the voluntary participation by the public, watershed councils, state and federal agencies, tribal partners, and certainly the goodwill of our landowners. I don't think we can ever divorce ourselves from the basic premise that was laid in the Oregon Plan with respect to voluntary compliance and participation, voluntary participation from our public. I think that is key to the whole program and concept. Chair Dingfelder, I conclude with that. If there are any questions that I may answer, I'll be happy to take those on now.
Any questions?
Madam Chair. I know I'm the curious one today. My apologies. Yes. Yeah, like I said, I was as a child. In your written testimony, in terms of the vision, defining success in terms of the biological status of species and habitat, is that something that will be okay with the feds?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Krupp, we have to work hand in hand with the feds on looking at delisting requirements. They're not there yet. We are the entity that's prodding them, so to speak. I think they're caught a little bit. I don't believe that they felt an urgency to look at recovery standards. We're seeing recovery at a faster rate than I think what anyone anticipated. Whether we can sustain that is another question. But we're certainly starting to see things come about that would warrant some considerations on moving those species off the list. It's looking promising. The component to that now is whether or not we can sustain that momentum that's been started in those fish populations. But once again, we have to work with NOAA Fisheries in order to identify those significant points where we can say we've attained delisting criteria.
So, Madam Chair, just one follow-up. So then, in essence, your your intent is to provide a framework, a policy, in essence, a definition of what recovery really means.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Krupp, that is correct. And we have worked through the Salmon Restoration Task Force to accomplish just that.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Representative Jensen and I co-chaired, and Senator Messily, the Salmon Recovery Task Force during the interim, and we're going to be hearing a bill that actually looks at defining recovery, and that's after 18 months just out of work on that one issue. So we worked very closely with your staff on that. I have a quick question about the STEP program and how that integrates with the Oregon plan, and if you could explain that a little bit, because I often get questions about that.
Chair Dingfelder, to get on the technical side of that, I'm going to call upon Bruce McIntosh, our scientist from our research center, who is also our coordinator from for the Oregon plan. Bruce, would you come forward, and we'll see if we can address that question for you.
Okay, thank you. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Bruce McIntosh. I am the Acting Assistant Conservation Recovery Program Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I believe your question was about how does the STEP program work within the context of the Oregon plan. As you know, STEP program is oftentimes a local effort that works with local landowners, local interests, and our staff. And there's been a strong recognition at the local level that STEP programs need to be cognizant and be melded within the Oregon plan itself. So I think that there's been a move away from some of the traditions around that and more closely aligned with such things we're trying to do under conservation recovery.
Okay. And there's, just for explanation for the committee, there's separate funding through ODF&W specifically for that program.
Madam Chair, I'd have to defer to Lindsay on that question.
Chair Dingfelder, that is correct. The money is set aside specifically for STEP.
And could you just, for background, just explain real briefly how the program works so folks here are trying to get up to speed on the Oregon plan can understand how that fits in with some of the other efforts that are going on?
Madam Chair, I'm not really the one that knows the details of how that program operates on the ground. Lindsay might want to address that, or we can.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, the STEP program started out in 1981, I believe, if I recall correctly. I would have to check the statute book for certain. But the interest in the STEP program at that time and continues to be to create volunteerism among the public and the department to restore and maintain salmon and steelhead in the state of Oregon through voluntary means. It started out as a hatchbox program where many, many people at the local level became engaged raising fish, receiving eggs from the Department of Fish and Wildlife to put into a small wooden hatch box on a tributary to a stream, supported by advice from staff. Those fish hatched out of those hatch boxes and were flushed into the different streams they were placed in. There was a lot of controversy about whether or not that program was really worth the effort. Mortality rate was believed to be high on those small fry being released in those streams that way. There was no clear way to monitor whether or not those fish coming back to those stream box or to that hatch boxes were from the hatch box or from natural spawn. People challenged whether or not that program was efficient in that means. It's been revised over time. You've seen there are several different STEP programs today. Depending upon the energy of the local people that want to engage and invest their time and money in those, to the point where some have very, very good hatchery facilities, actually, raising fish and releasing them with the guidance of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, all the way to STEP programs catching wild fish and introducing those stocks into our hatchery programs, where we go out
actually the volunteers, many of them guides and anglers, will go on a fishing trip. They have live wells and drift boats and power boats. They catch a wild fish. That fish is put into a live tank, brought to the hatchery, spawned, so we get that wild fish back into the hatchery program. So there are many aspects of the STEP program. If the committee would like, I can have our STEP coordinator come down and give you very specific activities and money spent on different projects. So it'd be the choice of the committee. There's specific information I just don't have available with me today.
Thank you. I'll talk with our committee staff and get back to you on that. Any other questions before I release the panel? Thank you very much.
Go back and spawn.
Do what?
Release the panel to go back and spawn.
Oh. Okay.
Before we adjourn, committee members, we have an update from Mr. Test about future meetings.
Chair Dingfelter, next week we'll continue on the same plan as far as overview on the Oregon plan. Monitoring will be the issue there, along with a visit with the independent multidisciplinary science team and their position. Agencies we'll hear from on Thursday will be DEQ, Forestry, and ODA. Then on next Tuesday, we'll talk more with the implementation groups, Health Insurance Partnership, Salmon Recovery Task Force, Soil Conservation Districts, Watershed Councils, and stakeholder organizations. And then on Thursday, the 6th, we planned a field trip to try and get out and actually take a look at some of the activities on the ground that Oregon Plan and OWEB oriented. I don't have a schedule yet, but to let you know, we're going to probably start a half an hour early at 8 o'clock. We'll let you know information about where we're leaving and where we're going with a more concise agenda once Jeff Huntington and his group provide me with that, and we can coordinate it. And generally, that's what we're going to be doing over the next 2 weeks. Just for information, Chair Jensen is home. He went home day before yesterday. We passed a card around, and the committee is considering, we're going to get him some sort of a gift, and we'll forward that on in the next couple days when I can get creative enough with the chairs to figure out what to get him.
Great. Thank you. Any other comments or announcements?
Just one thing in regards to the field trip. Dress appropriately, members. That means rubber boots. You may need waders. I'm not sure. Neoprene hunting suit, diving suit, whatever. Shopping.
Some of us who have extra pairs of boots.
Yeah, basically, Representative Krupp looks for any opportunity to wear a costume.
Thank you. The House Committee on Water is adjourned.